It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our state, Iowa, holds the number one ranking in the nation for incarcerating African Americans on a per capita basis. That's one of the reasons Iowa leaders are saying more must be done now to address disparities for minorities in the state's criminal justice system. And that will be a focus this week at the Iowa Criminal Justice Summit 2015 to be held Thursday, the 1st of October at the University of Northern Iowa. This hour, we want to explore some of the themes, the problems, and possible remedies. Joining us for the entire hour, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branches and founder of the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities. Betty Andrews, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us by phone from Washington, Vikrant Reddy is a senior fellow at the Charles Koch Institute, an expert on justice reform. Vikrant Reddy, welcome to you.
Hi, it's great to be on today.
And also in our Des Moines studio, Representative Helen Miller. She's a Democrat, House District 9 from Fort Dodge, worked as a defense lawyer in Washington at the trial and appellate level, also organized this summit, the Iowa Criminal Justice Summit. Representative Miller, thank you for
coming. My pleasure to be here.
Let's start with you, Representative Miller, and give us your thoughts on what's going to be happening later this week and why we need to have such a summit.
The reason I wanted to do this, I sit on the back row in the Iowa legislature, and I remember last year when Chief Justice Kennedy gave his remarks on the state of the judiciary in Iowa, and there were about 50 people sitting in back of me who were gasping when they heard the figures that he gave in terms of the levels of incarceration here in Iowa, and Iowa being the number one state. My thoughts went to what happens on a national level, and I really focused in on the fact that there was a lack of awareness. I talked to some news people who even told me that even though they report the news here in the state of Iowa, they were not aware of this. And so my first focus was to bring attention to it on a national level and perhaps get something started where we start in Iowa and move this ball forward, moving to various states and making sure that legislators, attorneys, law enforcement folks, and just the general public become aware of the problem. They can push for change.
Mm-hmm. For Thursday at the summit, what will be the top issues that will be addressed?
The top issues are pretty much all the issues that we talk about, but we're really focused on coming up with solutions that people can walk away with by the end of the day and have something that they can do. Our keynotes will be Mark Holden, who is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Koch Industries. And he's going to come and he's going to be on the program with Van Jones from Cut 50. They will be our keynotes. We also have Chief Justice Katie, who will be addressing juvenile justice issues here in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you expect there to be a great – I mean, before you get to solutions, it seems you must understand the problem and understand its causes. Do you see common understanding or great disagreement in what the causes are?
I think there is – to date now, as I talk to people, there's a common understanding. It's a growing common understanding. Like I said, the awareness is not there. And I think it's growing. And I think the efforts that groups like the NAACP have been making here in the state of Iowa have grown that awareness and have gotten more people engaged. And so I think it's time now to move the ball forward mm-hmm. in terms of what it is that we can all do. And I know that that group has a task force that's been meeting. I think they met the first time this week, and there'll be three more meetings. And I just like to be a part of the effort on a national level to make right. sure that these efforts move in many places. As I look across the landscape of the country, it's not happening.
So before we talk to Vikrant Reddy and Betty Andrews, what is your understanding in a nutshell of what the problem is? How, for instance, our state comes to hold the number one ranking for incarcerating African Americans on a per capita basis. And then how does that happen in a state like Iowa with the criminal justice system in Iowa within the national criminal justice system?
I do really, truly feel, and I have practiced criminal law going back to the early 80s, I think there is truly a feeling that black lives do matter less, and that if we, whatever we do with them, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. I was on a radio show with Mike Devine in my town the other day, and he gave me the example of when you have an elderly white woman who may be working in a county office somewhere, and maybe some of the funds have been embezzled. Well, he points out that she would probably get a much lighter sentence. Someone sees her as their mother. Someone sees her as their grandmother, mm-hmm. as their church member. When those people who arrest, the people who charge, the people who sentence African-Americans, I think many times they don't see them as their son or their daughter or as their friend or their neighbor or their church member. And so if you don't consider them like you consider yourself and those that you know, I think you tend to treat them differently. And I think that's what's happened to a very large degree. I think many folks are aware that they are doing that, and I think some folks may be unaware that they are doing that. But I think that they are definitely, that it is definitely happening.
Representative Helen Miller is with us, a Democrat, organizing this year's Iowa Criminal Justice Summit coming up on Thursday of this week. Vikrant Reddy, let me go to you, senior fellow at the Koch Institute in Washington, an expert on criminal justice reform. Do you size up the situation right now in the same way? What would you add?
Well, I think I agree with a lot of that. In fact, I probably agree with about 90% of it. I guess probably the and I do want to emphasize that, you know, we have a really tragic situation with criminal justice in our entire country right now. It's not just Iowa. And we've got really an epidemic of lives being wasted because they're forced to sit in these cages where they're not productive and where they're far from their families, from their communities, and those kinds of effects are cycling back into families and communities, and eventually the children of these people become incarcerated. These neighborhoods are just deteriorating. It's kind of an endless cycle. Now, the one area where I would probably disagree a little bit is, you know, on the question of the attitude towards black lives. I do think that people do care. And I do think that there is a great concern for black lives in the United States. But I think that we have kind of foolishly made policy decisions where that care that we may have is not being exhibited. That sounds a little complicated. Yeah. Let me give you an example.
Exactly.
Of what I mean. Yeah. So this is an example I like to use with a lot of people. I grew up in Texas. I grew up in a pretty suburban part of Fort Worth. And around my high school, there is nothing but football fields and baseball fields and things like that. Some people, on the other hand, grow up in urban parts of the country where their high school is located right across the street from the local drugstore, the grocery store, and it's right in the middle of town. If you pass a law, like we did many across the country in the 1980s and early 90s, where you say that if you sell drugs within X yards of a school, we're ratcheting up the penalty, we're doubling it or tripling it, that penalty is not going to affect people who live in suburban communities. It is going to affect the people who live in urban communities. And that means it's very likely to affect black Americans much more harshly than it affects white Americans. And I don't think that anybody intended that. In fact, the great irony is that the people who were advocating the most for those laws in the 1980s were often members of the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, who were saying, you know, we have to get the crack epidemic in our the community under control. Let's do something. Let's ratchet up penalties. And it was well-intentioned. And I think many of us probably supported those policies back then. But now we're dealing with a different criminal justice situation in the country. We're dealing with a different problem. The problem at this point is over-incarceration. Mm-hmm. It's not skyrocketing crime rates. Those are actually declining. So I think it's time to look at policies like that and undo them.
Okay. Give us a quick version of how would one go about undoing those things, the over-incarceration.
Sure. I think it starts with a kind of philosophical shift where we say we're not going to start treating every single violation with the instinctive response of incarceration. We start saying that if it is possible to treat people in the community, if it's possible to have a strong drug court or probation program or parole program for people who have done a little bit of time behind bars, first of all, right. We're going to focus on that. And I should note that those kinds of programs are actually far cheaper. This is really kind of a win-win across the board. You can spend less, you can get better results, you can save more lives.
Mm-hmm. And without sacrificing any public safety?
No, I don't think you would. And the reason I say that is because the evidence that we have across the rest of the country seems to indicate that although people intuitively think that incarceration rates and crime rates are linked, they really aren't. Incarceration rates in this country peaked in the year 2007. They've been going down every year since. And yet, while incarceration rates have been going down, crime rates have also been going down. Crime rates have been going down every year in the country since about 1994. And whether or not incarceration rates were rising or falling, crime just kept falling because of all kinds of other sociological reasons that go beyond locking people up.
Vikrant Reddy is with us from the Charles Koch Institute in Washington. Betty Andrews, of the president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branches, founder of the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities. You've been listening to what Vikrant and Representative Miller have had to say. Do you see it the same way? Do you see the problems the same way, Betty Andrews?
Actually, I do see a lot of what both of Representative Miller and Vikrant have been speaking about, and I do pretty much agree with all of what they are saying. I will note that while we have had a number of reductions in the crime rate and as well as the what has not gone down has been the disparity. And in particular, in the state of Iowa, we are finding that discretion is key to that. And so at every point where there is a discretionary issue, for instance, the first interaction with the police there, if you weighed that with an African-American versus a Caucasian, you would find that the African-American often is the person that is arrested. And as you step into the process of in terms of the criminal justice system, prosecution, judgment, and all of that, it as well as probation, all of those tend to statistically rate to the negative for African Americans.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea that Vikrant raised about possibly over-criminalizing smaller things, putting too many people in our jails and prisons?
I absolutely agree. And, you know, this past summer, President Clinton mentioned that, you know, his tactics with the war on drugs were misplaced to a large degree, which has resulted in the over-criminalization of a number of people and driven this disparity higher. Obviously, the disparity between the sentencing between crack and cocaine, those are things that are pretty much the same. However, they're looked at very differently in terms of the sentencing. So absolutely, I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Vikrant Reddy, you're here also to give us a conservative perspective. Would you say that things have changed over the last few years? If we look at the political spectrum and criminal justice reform, that there's a greater area of understanding, common understanding, overlap, and perhaps a way forward for bipartisan criminal justice reform?
No question. Things have changed significantly, and it's really kind of an unusual story because I'm not even sure bipartisan is the right word, because that implies that people on the left and people on the right have come together and there's the meeting of the minds. Something much more unusual has happened. People on the left are making arguments to their own base, and people on the right are making arguments to their own base, and yet they're kind of serendipitously ending up in the same place. So people on the left are making arguments, for example, about racial disparities, such as we've talked quite a bit about today, whereas people on the right are perhaps making arguments about second chances and redemption towards social conservative communities. They're making fiscal arguments about costs towards fiscally conservative communities. And ultimately, both sides are saying the same thing, but they're just using different reasons. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a very remarkable thing because, as everybody knows, we have a very polarized country right now. It's very difficult for both sides to come together on many issues. And this is one of the few issues in the whole nation on which people are getting to the same place. And they're able to get to that place without having to abandon any first principles on their side.
Do they see eye to eye when it comes to funding for the justice system, the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I think so. I can tell you the way conservatives think about this is I'd mentioned before that I was in that I came from Texas. I know some of those figures right off the top of my head. To incarcerate somebody in Texas for a day costs $50, but to put somebody on probation for a day in Texas costs $3. And so you've got conservatives in Texas who are saying, you know, you could really do a lot of good if rather than locking people up, you shut down some of those prisons. You took those savings and you used them to improve the probation and parole system. You used them to improve the drug courts.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's actually what happened in Texas. Legislation of that sort was passed in 2007. And in the years 2011 and 2013, Texas shut down a total of 3 prisons. And they were able to use the savings from shutting those prisons down into improving things like drug courts in the state. And that, in turn, has just continued to result in more reductions in crime and more unnecessary prison beds. It's really a fantastic model.
Representative Miller, here in Iowa, can we learn from this example just described by Vic Rentready in Texas?
I definitely think we can. And the thing I'd like to point out, too, is that it's very important that we have folks from all sides of the political spectrum here. As Betty Andrews just pointed out, when you talk about disparities, even though some of the reductions have happened, there hasn't really been a change in the disparities. And so when you have folks talking on one side or a side about overcriminalization and the financial impacts, et cetera, I think we also need to bring onto the table the fact that folks are looked at very much differently. African Americans, minorities are looked at differently. That starts from the time that you have policing in the community right through until people have been sentenced. And so everybody needs to get together, the left, the right, the middle, wherever anyone is, and talk about it holistically, because we still, in the final analysis, do have to definitely address this disparities question.
What about the disparities or the idea of people getting out of jail and prison after someone has served his or her term? Are we coming together in terms of reforms there, Vic Rentready, not putting up unnecessary barriers after someone has served a time for rejoining society, becoming gainfully employed, getting a job?
We're working on it, certainly. That I think, is kind of the next phase, but it's unbelievably important. Every single molecule of data that we have shows that the number one factor determining whether or not a person will go back to prison after they come out is whether or not they have a steady job. And there are a lot of components to that. You know, one component of it is, do you have housing so that you have a home base while you're job hunting? Another component of it is, are people willing to hire you? You know, there are a lot of policies now where you have to reveal from the very first step of the job application process that you've got this criminal background. And a lot of people worry that perhaps that's weeding them out at step one. Another really interesting point is that some people are prohibited from getting certain occupational licenses mm-hmm. for certain things because they've got a criminal record. And there's absolutely no connection between the license to, say, you know, cut hair or be a florist and whatever your criminal offense may have been. And so I think there's a real push across the country to review policies of this sort. And I really think that that's kind of the next big stage, and it's mm-hmm. profoundly important.
Betty Andrews, we have a couple minutes left of this half of the program. Talk about the post-incarceration period and the improvements you see can be made there. from your perspective.
And we also are addressing the issue of fair chance employment, and because, as Redick said, it definitely is a barrier to if you are not employed, the chances that you'll return to prison are go up substantially. So we're looking at, as I said, fair chance employment. Also known as Ban the Box. And at the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities, which happened on August 28th, we did a major presentation around this issue. And that's simply removing the box that asks if you have ever been convicted of a felony, a misdemeanor sometimes, and other crimes, even down to a traffic ticket. And so having that box removed gives a chance to the person who is applying for the position to be able to share their skills and share what makes them viable for the position.
How are you at the same time fair to the employer who is entitled to know certain knowledge of a certain level of if there's a criminal background?
Well, that often depends on the correlation of the issue in terms of sometimes you could have a person who committed a crime when they were 18. They are now 43, have not ever done anything since, but they still have to answer yes to that question. So it does, but this process also allows that once a job opportunity is either issued or even at the time of the interview, they can do a check or ask for that revelation. It's just a matter of allowing people to be able to get through the door, which is extremely important. Another piece in terms of after people have served their time is to, and in this state of Iowa, as you know, the governor has rescinded the executive order that allowed people with felony backgrounds to vote. And that's one more barrier in terms of making people feel like they are full and productive citizens. So,
okay. Mm-hmm. We have to go in just a moment.
Sure.
Betty, you'll be with us in the second half hour. Representative Miller, before we say goodbye, do you expect movement on this in the next legislative session in this area in January?
I most certainly do. We have a number of legislators who will be attending the conference in on Thursday, and I'm sure that the NAACP and the working group will be coming up with suggestions that as to legislation they'd like to see move forward. And so I'm hopeful that we will be able to set Iowa up as an example of how to move it.
Okay. Representative Helen Miller, Democrat, Iowa District 9 from Fort Dodge, organizing this year's Iowa Criminal Justice Summit coming up in a few days. Thank you very much for coming into our studio, Representative Miller.
Thank you.
And for joining us by phone, Vikrant Reddy, Senior Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Betty Andrews, you'll be staying with us, President of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branches. We'll be back with Betty Andrews, also with Judy Bradshaw, Director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. We'll talk with her about how officers can improve in terms of looking at situations on the street. Back in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, a recent conversation I had with former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He's got a new book out. It's called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. In it, he argues that power and influence have created a new American oligarchy, a shrinking middle class, and the greatest income inequality and wealth disparity in 80 years. He'll describe how he thinks we arrived at this level of economic inequality and what can be done about it. That's coming up tomorrow on the program. Former U.S. Labor Secretary, political economist Robert Reich. Today, we're talking about efforts for criminal justice reform here in Iowa. And with us from the first half hour, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branches, also founder of the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities. Betty Andrews, we wanted to get law enforcement. That was certainly mentioned several times during the first half hour by you. I think you used the term point of discretion.
Various points of discretion.
Definitely
include law enforcement.
Right. So the first, that would be the first point of discretion when an officer is deciding what to do and what may seem to be suspicious behavior or is looking for a certain person. Judy Bradshaw is director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, former Des Moines police chief. She has a lot of years on the street and as a police chief under her belt, a career of 34 years, seven of them as chief of police in Des Moines. She couldn't join us live for this conversation, but I talked with her earlier today, and I'd like to play a little bit of that tape here. And Betty Andrews, have you react to that perspective? I began the conversation with Judy Bradshaw by pointing out that at the ACLU, they have found that a black person in Iowa is eight times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person, despite equal usage rates. Also, studies showing black drivers more likely than whites to be asked if their vehicles could be searched. I started the conversation off by throwing those out and asking Judy Bradshaw, director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, what she thought of them.
You know, I have not seen the ACLU's report, so I'm not certain at, you know, how valid their reporting is. But I will say this, you know, I am certain that a large number of African Americans in our communities across the country do believe that they are stopped on a regular basis based on their race.
Do you believe that's in fact the case, whether it's eight times or another number, there is a disparity? Do you recognize that?
You know, I do know what the perception is, Ben, and I think law enforcement is hearing that loud and clear. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for leaders in law enforcement to realize that these perceptions exist, that we have to be sensitive to that. You know, part of the training is so very important. You know, right now at the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, we start out the first several weeks with the legal foundations of the authority that police officers have. And it's so very important to begin to talk about what that authority is, where it begins and where it ends as a law enforcement officer. So, training is an integral part in creating the mindset for police officers. We get that.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you say perceptions, whereas, for instance, the ACLU says, you know, no, this is hard data here. What if, you know, if you're trying to tackle a problem and one side says, or some people say it's a perception, others say, no, this is founded in actual data, how do you come to a way forward?
Well, you know, officers are trained on reacting to behavior-based, you know, to the police officer is allowed under the law to react to probable cause. And you are, you know, empowered to react to behavior-based actions. Mm-hmm. And so if an officer is claiming that they have observed something that's illegal or suspicious, and they can articulate that by law, you know, that's really where our training goes, and that's, mm-hmm. that's really significant. Now, there's again, I think everyone acknowledges that there is a perception based on, you know, viewpoints of the African-American community that they are stopped more than whites. Mm-hmm. And that it's based on racial profiling, and I guess if the data says that they're stopped more than whites, I haven't seen what the data says on if it's behavior based or not. Okay, mm-hmm. And that's what I think that's what you're when you get into the details. I think that's what's significant is, you know, when you take a look at these stops. Were there valid reasons for the officers to stop the drivers of the cars? And that's where, you know, I think that the research and the data gets a little murky. So rather than argue over what, you know, the data says or doesn't say, I think it's important for the law enforcement leaders to recognize the sensitivities that are out there, that a large share of the African-American community believe, whether it's true or not, but they do believe that they are targeted by officers based on their race. And I think from there, then you can begin to build on, you know, your sensitivities. And, you can begin to be detailed about why you made the stop. I think folks, you know, citizens, whoever you are, you have a right to know why you were stopped, and you have a right to be told the details of the circumstances surrounding the stop.
Do you think that police officers today, because of the things that are happening across the country, the last couple of years, Ferguson and whatnot, that police officers across Iowa are looking at behavior and saying that behavior is something I need to look out, I need to check out, I possibly need to pull a driver over. But then also the other question saying, doing a double check, saying, let me be sure here, this is behavior-based, not skin color-based. Do you think that is the sensitivity you're talking about?
Right, right. That officers by law, I mean, it's so important, you know, that when you lay the foundation of the training, that they know that their traffic stops and that their own actions have to be driven by someone's behavior. And many times, you know, there's a description that's placed out, you know, by victims. I mean, there's a whole other side to crime, and in most crimes, there's a victim. And in a lot of the circumstances, there are descriptions. And the officers are going, you know, they're reacting to trying to locate the offender based on the victim's descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're reacting and they're being driven by details. Now, my experience, and I was out on the streets for a long time in Des Moines, and, you know, I've seen it both ways. I have stopped drivers who have said to me, challenged me and said, you're stopping me only because I'm African American. And sometimes that's used to challenge the officer and to redirect the focus on the officer's behavior. And, you know, the officer just has to sort of stand their ground to a certain extent and get to the bottom of why, you know, the initial stop was made, you know, identify who that person is and make a determination as to whether or not they're involved in the initial crime. And I've had it go both ways. I've had it be to where I've stopped the right person, and those challenges and those questions right off the bat didn't work, and an apprehension was made because I had the right driver. But I've also had it go the other way, where we sifted and sorted through the details of the circumstances, and I was able to tell the driver, you know what, you're not who I was looking for. This is why you were stopped. These are the details as best that you can disclose them. And what you try to do under those circumstances is leave that interaction in a positive way. That sometimes doesn't always happen.
But as director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, you do see room for improvement.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's what this is all about, is acknowledging the perceptions of our citizens in our community and beginning to talk about how are we building on our authority to stop people, cars, folks on the street, based on what legalities, and then how should that interaction be? Even if they challenge you, and they're right, you know, mm-hmm. if they challenge you and say, you didn't have a right to do this, and I'm upset about this, and you believe you had a right to do it, and they weren't the person you're looking for, how do you now end that, you know, in a way that doesn't make them feel as though they were stopped based on their race, but based on behavior or a description or some other information that you can share with them? And I don't think we've always done that. I don't think as law enforcement officers we've always disclosed, you know, all the details at the end of those interactions. And that's what I'm talking about. That's where there's room for improvement, to talk about the sensitivities, to talk about how we're doing things, and to begin to gain some ground here, because in the end, what we're talking about is respect for folks, that all citizens that you interact with.
Conversation I had earlier today with former Des Moines Police Chief Judy Bradshaw, now director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. Betty Andrews of the NAACP joining me live. You listened to that conversation. Judy Bradshaw could not join us live over the noon hour. How do you view that perspective coming from law enforcement? Do you see areas of disagreement there?
Well, I definitely see I'm challenged with early on in the interview where she mentioned that she had not actually seen the ACLU study. And then further into the interview, it becomes about perception and whether or not and a little bit dismissive about the data in that study.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that study, there are a number of other studies that are out there. Even the fact that we are, according to the Sentencing Project, about 13.6 times more likely African-Americans, that is, to be incarcerated or under the criminal justice system supervision. So certainly it is disturbing. And then when we look at perception, I think that perception goes both ways. And is it what is the perception of the officer that is doing the stopping? But I also want to back up and say that this is more than just the officer on the street. This is about policies and how those play out as they filter down through the through law enforcement. I'll also state that it is important to have that we have law enforcement, and I don't want to be misconstrued that we definitely understand the value of law enforcement and also of good policing.
Right.
But there is definitely something wrong when you look at the exponential times that African-Americans are engaged, and specifically that ACLU study, 8 times more likely. That's pretty radical. That's, 800%.
They're just you're saying an indication they're given much more scrutiny when Judy Bradshaw says, listen, we have to drill into our police officers that the question is, are these behavior-based stops valid? That's a good question.
Oh, I think it's absolutely a good question as to whether or not they are valid. But I would also say that unless African-Americans in Iowa are hugely worse than African-Americans elsewhere, that unless the general public is hugely better than elsewhere,
right,
it would not be likely that we would be coming up with statistics that are several times higher than the national norm.
Betty Andrews, I understand you have helped or drafted law, Iowa law, that addresses what you call racial profiling in the state. Can you share with us the gist of that?
And actually, the national NAACP does have a model law, and I know that there was some legislation that was submitted last year by Representative Bruce Hunter. And what we have done here locally is we, along with several coalition partners, including the ACLU, we're looking at and we're revising some of the racial profiling that was modeled, that was presented at the national level, and then also taking a look at Representative Hunter's bill. And so what our legal redress committee is doing is putting together some legislation that we think would be appropriate for the state of Iowa. We're also across the state, because the NAACP represents over 30 branches of the organization. And so what we're doing locally is we're actually meeting with various police chiefs and police administrations to see what their current racial profiling policy is. We think it's quite interesting that 31 states throughout the country have some form of legislation around racial profiling, but Iowa does not. And recently, Nebraska passed some racial profiling legislation. So we do feel that Iowa needs to come into the year 2015, and I guess when the session begins, 2016, and adopt racial profiling legislation that makes it not optional, to make sure that we are covering issues of racial profiling.
Betty Andrews is with us of the NAACP. We want to have Rob Hogue join us also for the rest of the hour. State Senator Rob Hogue is a Democrat from Iowa Senate District 19 of Cedar Rapids. He has served on the Judiciary Committee in both the House and the Senate. Senator Hogue, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon. Happy to be on the show.
Let's start with the point that Betty Andrews has about racial profiling. Iowa seemingly not getting any laws having to do with racial profiling where other states have it. Do you see that coming to our state?
Well, I think that is something that I certainly would support, and I think the process should work here, and we should get that legislation considered this year. And I understand we're going to be getting recommendations from the task force, which would really help if that task force recommended such a law.
Absolutely.
We need, you know, we have a significant disparity in Iowa, and we've got to acknowledge that it is, maybe it's based on some people's perceptions. It's also a reality. And the thing that concerns me the most is we are, I think we're just incarcerating far too many of our African Americans in our state. And what's bad is that we need people to be in the community and be productive. That's my biggest concern. And racial profiling, I think there are points of discretion, I think, as Betty said, and that's where it starts. But it goes throughout the correctional system and the criminal justice system, and we really need to work on it. That's why I'm excited about going to the summit that Representative Miller has organized this Thursday in Cedar Falls.
Also, we will mention the governor. Governor Branstad recently created a working group on justice policy reform. I wonder, Senator Hoag, where do you see what areas that there are so many different moving parts in our criminal justice system? Where do you see the low-hanging fruit, if I can put it that way, to improve our system?
Well, I think the biggest thing, Ben, that people need to realize is that over 90% of the people who go into prison are going to come out someday. And we have programs that work to reduce recidivism. Drug courts is an example of that. We've had a 25% roughly reduction in recidivism from people going through drug courts compared to comparable people who did not go through drug courts. We know that education, housing, employment, and treatment, both for substance abuse and mental health, these are the ways that you can prevent recidivism. And so we need to work with people coming out of the prison system to get them education, housing, employment, and treatment. Why? Well, in part, it's the right thing to do, but in part, it's also what works to keep the community safer. And really, the bottom line for me is public safety. If we want a safer community, we need to work with people on an individual basis so that they are less likely to reoffend or less likely to offend in the first place.
What about funding here? You mentioned drug courts. Despite their popularity among prosecutors, judges, and community leaders, several Iowa drug courts are experiencing or have experienced sluggish legislative funding that also even puts them in jeopardy. What's the problem with funding if they are shown to be so effective and making sense in terms of both rehabilitation and economic terms for the state?
Yep. Well, unfortunately, the state has put itself in a position where our budget's fairly tight. The Department of Corrections did not tell us this year in the legislative session that they thought any of the drug courts were in jeopardy. I don't remember hearing that, at least. I should say it that way. Maybe they did tell us, but I certainly don't remember it. The legislature's had strong support for drug courts, really back to when Tom Hancock was the chair of our Justice Budget Committee, 7-8 years ago. And we have followed that through. Senator Courtney has followed that through, and we've had strong support for drug courts. Very disappointed this year and surprised when I heard that they were closing, because we were under the impression we had adequate funding to keep them open. So that's something that's not acceptable, and we need to make sure that we keep these programs up and running, because they do work. We've had over 1,100 people graduate from drug court in Iowa over the last 15 years, and they work. And so these programs that we know that work need adequate funding. And the problem is it kind of gets down to priorities at some level. I know one of your earlier guests talked about the bipartisan support. We do need bipartisan support. And sometimes tax cuts take precedence over funding the basics like this. And we need to continue to advocate for the basics, because we know this stuff works. We know it's the right thing to do. And it works and keeps people safe.
Okay, thank you very much. We've run out of time. State Senator Rob Hoag, Democrat, Iowa Senate District 19, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branches and founder of the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities. Thank you for joining us for the entire hour, Betty Andrews. It's been enlightening.
It's been my pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation I had recently with former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. His latest book, his new book, is called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.